In early 1962, Lauren spent several months away from the activities of his job, seeking God's direction for the future. And as a result of these several months, he came up primarily with two things. First of all, the reestablishing of specific promises from God. And I'm sure that all of you have heard him say at one time or another that the NAV work is not built upon principles or methods, but upon the promises of God. And probably the foremost promise at that time was Isaiah 54, 2 and 3, enlarge the place of thy tent, and let them stretch forth the curtains of thine habitation, and so on. And I recall that he came back, well, particularly in 63, he was preaching, by 63, he was preaching Isaiah 54, 2 and 3 quite strongly. The second thing that he concluded during this time was a recognition of a reasonable, normal growth rate based on the past and what we can see of the future. He called it a record in advance of what is inevitable. And at that time, this was established at a growth rate of 25% for the U.S. work and 15% overseas through 1966. And since then, of course, this has sort of resolved itself into a 15% annual growth rate worldwide. At that time, we had 29 area reps in the U.S. and 20 overseas. And I mention this not only because it's a product of Doss's several months alone, of Lauren's several months alone with the Lord, but because from time to time, this certain percentage growth rate is resisted and kicked at and questioned and so forth, and there's some feeling on the part of some, I suppose, that it's an arbitrary thing that Lauren just dreamed up. But it did come about specifically as a result of his time with the Lord. Now, this percentage may vary from time to time, but the concept, the fact that the growth rate can be predicted on the basis of what God has done for us in the past, and I think that's the key, on the basis of what God has done for us in the past. And this was set up as being a minimum. At that time, he also made this statement, the basic unit of the NAV work is a contact, a man on a ship, a key student, or so forth. The area rep supervises contacts within 250 miles. And then he says this, eventually, as areas increase, we need regions with regional directors. This was in 1963 that he wrote this. He was beginning to see down the road what was going to be necessary in the way of organizational structure to care for this growing work. At that time, in 1963, people who were responsible for finances and so forth at the time worked on budget projections through 1970. And the budget for 1970 was projected to be $1,910,000. The actual budget for this year is $3,248,000, or well over a million more than it was actually, or more than 50% than the projection that was made for this year back in 1963. So we see that the work is accelerating and growing at a pace that was even not foreseen at that time. Let's switch emphasis at this point and begin to trace some of the overseas work. And the first significant thing about this to keep in mind is that it essentially began as an other works emphasis. Though there were exceptions to this rule, such as Robertson originally going out to fly the Navigator flag in China, it was essentially men going out to help other organizations with counselor training, follow-up, correspondence courses, this sort of thing. Characteristic of our early stages of overseas work were men spread very thinly, one man to a country, or at the most maybe two men to a country. Little emphasis on learning the language, because the men were expected to go out and to get to work right away, and they were usually, of course, involved with masses or with key nationals who could speak English. And so the emphasis on learning language did not come along until several years later. In 1955, something happened in Japan. I call it the Japan Doctrine Crisis, that almost obliterated the work in Japan. At that time, we had four staff members assigned to Japan, plus two or three more that were sort of passing through en route to other places in the Orient. And these fellows, Roy Robertson, who was in charge of the Japan work, was home on furlough, and the fellows there became involved in an extreme Pentecostal type of situation. And the result of that was that we lost three of our four staff members in Japan. And this set the work back considerably at that time. In 1955, Dan Pyatt became the first Europe director. Dan had been sent to Europe several years earlier to direct the Servicemen's Center in Naples, Italy. He got kicked out of Italy for reasons of which are not real clear in my mind. But of course, Italy was a very difficult place for Protestants to do work of any kind. And Dan couldn't restrain himself to working just with American servicemen. He moved up to Holland, supposedly to take over the work in Holland, and I think en route up there, or shortly after he got there, Doss appointed him the Europe director. And this is a notable event because it marks the first step in organizing an area, a geographical structure in any way, both either in the U.S. or overseas. That is, it's the first time that somebody was appointed a director between Dawson and the guy out in the front lines. That was 1955, and in 1956, Doug Sparks returned from Formosa, and though he arrived back in the States right at the time of Dawson's homegoing in the transition, Dawson had already set it up, or it was in his mind anyway, that Doug would be appointed overseas coordinator. And again, notice the use of this term coordinator rather than director, because all of the overseas fellows were still to report directly into Doss or DeLorne. But it's significant, or it's noteworthy, whether it's significant or not, that the overseas work started to be sort of structured before the U.S. work. And I'm not sure that we can explain the reason why, other than that the U.S. work was closer geographically and lent itself more to direct supervision from the little building on the other side of the Red Rocks there. Whereas there was a recognition that overseas, there was a geographical factor that necessitated sort of a structuring and an organizing of the work. In 1956 was our entry into Africa, the fellows landing in Kenya the same day that Dawson landed in heaven, and still going in under the Other Works flag with Pocket Testament League and Africa Inland Mission. In 1961, we had here at the Glen, or they had here at the Glen, the first overseas policy conference. And this started what I call the policy conference era, or clarifying the objective era. But But Doug Sparks and Bob Boardman and Robertson, maybe Scott, various fellows from the U.S., met at the Pink House for a couple of weeks for this first overseas policy conference. We had this in 1961. We had a training policy conference in 1963, and there have been various conferences since then. Just to assure you that they didn't sit around and drink coffee and so forth, these are the notes from the training policy conference in 1963. And you could probably spend the rest of your 8 or 9 days here reading through this thing. So they did a lot of work. And when you boil it down, you know, the statements that came out of there, you wonder what it was all about. But these conferences were pretty painful and excruciating for the participants. Some of these significant things that came out of this overseas policy conference in 1961 was, number one, the decision to fly our own flag rather than enter countries under other organizations. Again, these are in the notes that you'll be getting after this session. The decision to fly our own flag, to go into countries from henceforth strictly as navigators. Secondly, the decision to narrow our objective because we were spread too thin and were involved in too many things. And this necessitated the formulating or the stating of that objective. And as far as I know, this is the first effort to state the navigator objective in print this concisely. We had navigator brochures and what have you long before this, kind of explaining the navigators. But at this time, January 1961, the conference concluded the objective of the navigators is to contribute to the fulfillment of the Great Commission by producing reproducers, and then in parentheses, and assisting others to produce reproducers in every nation. The two things that are notable about that objective, number one, the use of the term producing reproducers. Betty was telling me that up until that time, there had been sort of a shakiness about using this term too loudly. And part of the problem was that it was coined by Doss about the time that of this situation that John told us about when this key man almost split the work. And this was one of the things that was jumped on, was this term producing reproducers. And so apparently there was a kind of a drawing back from using that term too loudly. But at that time we came out and we stated it, we put it in the objective. The objective of the navigators is to contribute to the fulfillment of the Great Commission by producing reproducers. The second thing is in every nation. Another thing that came out of that conference, and I'm going to go back and pick up this objective a little later on, but just to tie up the 61 conference, the last thing that came out of that was an emphasis, a stated emphasis on learning the language. Now, we had probably in the year or two prior to that been moving in this direction, but in 1961, it was put out in black and white. You know, the people would be expected to learn the language when they went into a new country. And this, of course, is a move away from this moving in and getting involved right away in a big deal using a key national as one's interpreter. And this conference brings us to what I call the policy era, or clarifying the objective era, from 1961 to 1968. And I've mentioned this overseas policy conference and the statement of the objective. At the same time, in that conference in 61, they formulated and stated an immediate objective. And that was this. The objective of the navigators in the next 10 years, that is in the 60s, is to demonstrate, and that word demonstrate is underlined, producing reproducers in every country where we decide to operate. And this touches on a couple of things. First of all, the recognition that perhaps our preaching had gotten ahead of our performance, and that we were going around preaching to a lot of other works, missionary conferences and conferences of missionaries on the mission field, this concept of producing reproducers, but when we really looked around, there wasn't a great deal of Exhibit A kind of thing. And so we concluded that instead of preaching, that our objective would be, or they concluded that the objective would be to demonstrate during the next 10 years. And you can form your own conclusions as to whether or not that objective was accomplished, because we're out of that 10 years now. The second significant thing about this is in every country where we decide to operate. Now, notice in the big objective was in every nation. But for the 10 years, there was the recognition that we had to be a little more deliberate about where we went. And we were growing into this concept of prayerful planning and staging areas and this kind of thing of sending fellows on forays. And those of you in the U.S. areas will recognize this as going to the next campus or the next base down the highway kind of a thing, rather than leapfrogging and getting into a situation clear on the other side of your state. And we realized that in the next 10 years we would not be operating in every nation, and that some decisions had to be made. And at a later conference they set up a very complete set of guidelines for establishing priorities for entering a country. I am not touching on those guidelines in this presentation because it's not clear in my mind that they're still valid. That is, that we still recognize them as the guidelines that we're using. These were the things that came out of that first overseas policy conference in 1961. The next conference was the training policy conference, and that was the notes I showed you a few minutes ago. September 1963. Two things were probably significant from that. One was that it was actually at that conference that we began to get a clue that something was wrong with the training program set up here at Glen Eyrie. A lot of the discussion centered around that, and it was a year later that this thing finally was crystallized and the action was taken. But the first expressions of questioning began to come up at that training policy conference in September 63. The second thing was that this objective that was so clearly stated 2.5 years prior in 1961 was brought out and taken apart and not put back together again. And I'm not sure that it is yet put back together again. We'll see when Lauren talks to you in the next 2 or 3 days. There is a very lengthy, and in fact, much of this book that I showed you has to do with debate and discussion over the objective. And it evolves around two issues. One, stated by Lorne, and my purpose in putting Lorne's name by this is not to put him on one side of the fence or the other, but to show you the level at which this discussion and debate was carried on. But Lauren made this statement. The objective of NAV training is to produce laborers of many kinds. The means of carrying this out are laborers of a special kind, And he used the term spiritual multipliers, or producing reproducers. And this was debated, and the debate waxed rather warmly at times. Others brought out, they said, the end objective of the navigators must be producers of reproducers in order to get these other kinds of laborers, which would come about as a byproduct of producing reproducers. In other words, it's stated like this: the objective of the navigators is laborers of many kinds, and in order to perpetuate the work, we've got to have some producers of reproducers doing this. And then the other side says, no, the objective of the navigators is producers of reproducers, and the others, the labors of many kinds, will spill out along the way, kind of like a stream overflowing its banks. Now, at one point, Lorne had the delegates polled on this, and their names are recorded for posterity. On this question: what end product do we want in terms of what a person can do? What end product do we want in terms of what a person can do? And here's the vote tally. Producing reproducers, 9. Form a band of men, 1. Apparently this person was on a real kick on this at the time. Build disciples, 4. Bring people to the place of fulfilling their function in the body of Christ, 11. Now, if we equate building disciples with producing reproducers, and I'm not sure that's a valid equation, but if it is, then we've got 13 for producing reproducers and 11 for this laborers of many kinds, or helping people to fulfill their function in the body of Christ. So I said, I wonder about the present DDs and RDs and so forth. So I went down, and the guys who are now DDs and RDs, and again, the vote was split. There was not a unanimity. Some guys who are DDs voted for producing reproducers, and others voted for fulfilling their function in the body of Christ, and the same way with the RDs. Now, this points out, you know, and there's no point in sweeping this under the rug. This points out the tension that exists, and maybe it's a healthy tension. I'm not saying that it's wrong, but nevertheless, it's there. The tension that exists within the staff today over this concept of what is the objective. And this is the reason that we have probably never been able to state the objective in a way that everyone is happy with it. Because there are these two basic concepts. And probably, if the truth were known, everybody is doing both. You know, but when we get into the theoretical part of it, one wants to emphasize one and then two, and the other says, no, one and then two, kind of a thing. So that was probably the main thing that came out of the training policy conference, was this lack of anything coming out on the statement of the objective. We took it apart and did not put it back together again. The other significant thing that evolved from this, well, I mentioned the beginning to question the concept of the training here at Quinary. That would be a second one. A third one would be that at this conference, Lorne first presented the concept of fellowship as an identifiable, important element in the discipling of people. Now, I was not aware, John, of this concept being existent so long, long ago there, as you brought out yesterday. But in any event, in 1963, it was brought back in. Lorne first began to talk about fellowship as an identifiable, important element in the discipling of men. I lost my notes here on that. I guess I have. But, no, wait a minute. I'm looking in the wrong place. He says that there are three things that are necessary to disciple people: prayer, the word, and testimony. And then he says, but they need a fourth thing. They need a fellowship. They need the atmosphere or setting or environment of a fellowship. Such a fellowship grows out of the nature of man and out of the nature of Christianity. And then he gives seven things that are characteristic of fellowship. And these are not in the notes. I'm going to just cover them real quickly. But Christ-centered, biblically based, the more mature leading the less mature, or leadership. Freedom for expression by all. Within freedom of expression comes an atmosphere of intimacy or closeness, fostered by openness of heart. Should be characterized by discipline or self-activity before they arrive. That is, there should be some kind of an assignment involved in fellowship. And then, in order to maintain this proper atmosphere, they must get individual attention as needed along the way. So this was 1963, when Lorne began to work on reinstating this element of fellowship. This was not culminated until 5 years later, 1968, at the World Regional Directors Conference, when fellowship was officially voted in as a spoke of the wheel. And one of the things that caused that to be voted in was the recognition on the part of the fellows that this is something we'd been practicing without just, you know, openly identifying it and saying this is an essential ingredient. After the Training Policy Conference of 63, the next thing is the Overseas Policy Conference of November 1966. And at this point, they formulated this statement of the objective, which probably most of you have seen. The objective of the Navigators is to help fulfill the Great Commission by multiplying laborers. This was followed by an 18-point statement of what we understood that to mean at that time. And I'm sure most of you have seen this sheet, or two sheets, this statement. And then, as of November 1966, we understand this to mean, followed by these 18 points. Still working on trying to put back together what had been taken apart in 63. The 1967 Directors' Conference did not deal so much with this big objective. The next time that was dealt with was in 68. But in 67, some significant things evolved from a smaller conference consisting of a very few men. Four things. One, they concluded that the primary objective for the U.S. work at that time should continue to be the production of representatives and money for the worldwide work of the Navigators. In other words, instead of ministering to the area, to use Leroy's phraseology, we would continue to minister in the area with the idea of drawing out, recruiting men out of the area for the worldwide work. A second objective for the U.S. work was that we must put into operation the conservation of what was a person who was dubbed at that time the basic NAV product. That is, the fellow or the girl that we had ministered to, the person who was not being recruited to the NAV organization. We were unable to officially define this person or to describe him. But we knew that there was a basic NAV product and that we needed to start putting into operation the conservation of these people so that we didn't lose out the back door what had come through the front. And then thirdly, our intention was stated at that time to develop a worldwide NAV work for the purposes of a worldwide impact. Now, there is some degree of question in my mind about the statement, how seriously we took the statement in 1961 to produce reproducers in every nation. Because being around at that time, there seemed to be kind of a tendency to say, well, this every nation concept was Das's grandiose vision. And we're a little more realistic. And we realize that probably God hasn't called us into every nation, but to certain nations. Now, whether or not I read the atmosphere rightly or wrongly, I'm not sure, but in any event, I think I read it correctly, because at this 67 conference, Lorne kind of planted both feet firmly on this concept. God wants us to make an impact for Christ in every nation of the world. The fourth thing that came out of that, this was our first attempt at careful evaluation of our progress in a country. How are we actually doing? And, numbers were put on the board in terms of disciples and disciple makers. And this was at this conference that the phrases or the terms disciple makers and makers of disciple makers were coined as being perhaps more expressive than producers of reproducers and so forth. Then in 1968, the World Regional Directors Conference, I've already mentioned the wheel was changed at that time. We again had a lengthy debate on the objective. It was left unresolved. And thirdly, this was the first time, it was at that time that we began to discuss a strategy for the 70s. Now, Lorne will be talking to you in the staff conferences that have preceded. He already has talked about strategy for the 70s. But Scotty presented a paper which was the object of discussion for several days on a strategy for the 70s. And this was the first effort that was made in trying to line something out for the next 10 years. Now, the last item I want to touch on is the significance of the change in leadership from Dawson to Lorne. First of all, some comments on Dawson's style of leadership. He was a strong, dominant personality, always coming up with new ideas. A strong, central leadership. Everyone reported directly to him. When I came here in 1955, one of the responsibilities that I was given was what was called at that time the civilian department. We later called it the correspondence department. But, I reported directly to Doss. And if I wanted to make a change in procedure in the civilian department, I checked it out with Doss. He had his hand in many things. He was involved personally or through supplying men with many organizations. Wycliffe, Missionary Aviation Fellowship, Youth for Christ, World Vision, Orient Crusades, Campus Crusades. His life was, you've heard the expression, these many things I dabble at, or this one thing I do. Neither of those expressions were characteristic of Doss, but rather these many things I do. He did all of them. He did all of them well, because he was an unusual person. But he had his hand in many things, and we've seen this in these few hours together. And then another characteristic of his leadership is, I think Betty coined this phrase, hip pocket organization. Figuratively speaking, she said he refused to carry a briefcase. He actually did, but he didn't want to be involved in organization. He'd probably turn over in his grave at some of the things we're doing today. Now, the significance of Dawson's leadership style on the work. First of all, and these are judgmental areas here, these are my conclusions, and enabled him and the navigators to pioneer. One characteristic of pioneering is the trying of things that don't necessarily work, and the selecting out of that those things which do work, without a sense of failure about it all. But enable Doss to pioneer and to build a foundation for the present. His wide interest in other works and in many areas of activity gave a breadth to the work. When you think today of our emphasis on keeping the objective clean and narrow, if we did not have this broad foundation, we could be pretty sectarian and provincial and narrow in our thinking. Wycliffe, but who are they? Youth for Christ? Who? But because of this heritage that we have, of this broad interest in other works, we at least today have an awareness. And probably one of the lessons that we can learn from this is the necessity of maintaining this awareness through some other means, because it won't last forever. And then, thirdly, this man of faith set the tone for the work today. And this is still a work of faith. Regardless of all of our planning, both personnel and finances, when you come right down to it, it's still a work of faith. June 18, 1956, at age 50, Doss went underwater at Scroon Lake, New York, never to appear again alive, that is. Lorne was 35. He had been with Dawson 15 years. Six or seven of those, he had spent primarily in the Graham Crusades. Someone was asking me a question at coffee break about the transition, and I remarked that it was very obvious to the staff. We had staff conference that year in August, just a couple of months after Dawson went to be with the Lord, and it was very obvious to all hands that God had anointed Lorne for the job of leadership. There was an air of God-given authority and confidence that was displayed at that staff conference. It was unique. While we were staggered at that time by the loss of Dawson, and some of you here were in this room that day in June 56. Some of us were here when Rod made this announcement to us. We were staggered. And yet, in retrospect, we see God's sovereign timing. God knew what he was about, what he was doing. And so let's go then to Lorne's leadership style and its impact on the work. Lorne is basically a team leader. He relies heavily on his men. He emphasizes a decentralized leadership. The very fact that Betty and John and I are up here giving this NAV history rather than Lorne is an illustration of this. Lorne is objective-centered. I've heard him say scores of times that his main job is to clarify and maintain the objective of the navigators. And he works at this night and day. And then Lorne is continually seeking the best organizational structure. Whether it's the headquarters office or the overseas work or the U.S. areas work, you know, he's continually tying up this loose end and making this slight change here or this big change over there. He's continually seeking a better way to organize the work to get the job done most effectively. And sometimes this causes a little restlessness with some of us. You know, we think, well, man, we just got this settled 3 months ago, and now here we are discussing it again. But he's constantly working at this. The significance of Lauren's leadership style. First of all, it is conducive to a widespread growth, both numerically and in maturity of the staff. By decentralizing responsibility, he allows the staff to mature, and this in itself allows the staff to grow numerically. The constant clarifying of the objective results in keeping it clean and narrow. And as I mentioned to Betty, I think that this fact makes it possible for a lot of us to be on the staff. I'm not sure that many of us could operate a six-ring circus, but we can operate a one-ring circus. You know, we can zero in on that one objective. And then thirdly, while we are still a family, and as Lauren mentioned the other night, we always want to be a family, we also have to admit, whether we like it or not, that we are an organization. And his constant working on the organizational structure is necessary for the growth of this part of things, and especially from this point on. And so we might say, in the words of 1 Corinthians 3, in paraphrasing here, that Doss built the foundation, and Lauren is building their own, along with you and me. And let every man take heed how he builds on it. Well, that concludes the history, except for things that you want to ask questions on or want someone to elaborate on further. And John and Betty, I think it would be good if both of you would come up here.